Hebrews tonight. If you have your study guide, you can also turn and see what I've got here marked for the page. I think it is page 314. If you have that, if you're here new or visiting, you don't have this. We're working through a book together, and we are 300 pages into the book, so we're getting near the end. So if you don't have it, it'll be okay. We're going to also be turning to the text. So let's look in the book of Hebrews, and then on page 314. And don't forget that the book of Hebrews is difficult to interpret. It's difficult to understand because it's written to a Jewish audience. And if you don't understand some of the Jewish... Okay, if you don't understand the Jewishness of the Old Testament sacrificial system and all the laws there, it's hard to understand where the writer's coming from in this letter. So it's not a very easy book to go through. And I've said this before, after the book of Revelation, Hebrews is probably the next most difficult book to interpret and preach through. So I've never tackled the book in depth. At some point I might, but I will also say this, if after 140 sermons in the book of Revelation, or whatever it takes, we may switch this up a little lighter after that book, but we're in chapter 15. We're going to finish chapter 15 this Sunday. That's the plan. I think we can. I hope we can. And that's going to then set us up to start with the bowls of wrath at the very end of the tribulational period in chapter 16. But having said that, we're not going to be back in Revelation for quite some time because of different things coming up with the month of June, which I'll explain those on Sunday. So anyway, Hebrews is not a very easy letter to understand. So look at the middle of page 314, where we left off last week. So what we did last week, there were six examples of ways God spoke in the Old Testament. And so I'm looking at my list here. He spoke through dreams. He spoke through a cloud of fire. He spoke directly sometimes. He spoke through signs. He spoke through symbolic actions with Ezekiel. And then we saw an example with Daniel, how he would speak through a vision. So the reason that we looked at that is what he states in the very first verse of the letter. And so if you look back in the first two verses, I think this kind of sets the tone some for the letter. So remember that Hebrews does not start like a normal New Testament letter, okay? Paul writing to people in Corinth, blessings upon y'all, love y'all, but I wish y'all would stop messing up in church. That's kind of the summary of 1 Corinthians. So this one doesn't start like that. And remember too, if you get on Jeopardy, Final Jeopardy, the authorship of Hebrews is not known, right? Nowhere does he state exactly who's writing this. And there's been some guesses, and we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. So here's how it starts. Okay, here it goes. Throw it out there for these Jewish believers. God, that's a good way to start. Okay, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways. So what's the long ago? That's the Old Testament. Okay, when the nation of Israel is birthed, you know, promises to Abraham, and we've got, you know, Jacob, his name is changed to Israel, the 12 sons of Israel, we've got the tribes of Israel. So long ago, when he spoke to the fathers, he did so through the prophets. And there's lots of ways he did that, which is what we looked at last week. Dreams, visions, cloud, things like that. But then, in verse 2, he says, he spoke like that long ago, but now in these last days, he's spoken to us in his Son. That changes everything. Okay, this is not a dream. It's not a vision. It's not a cloud of fire. This is in his Son. Okay, this is giving a weight to this letter that really does set the tone for everything else you're going to read. Because remember, in the book, I won't write it up here, but remember, I see the letter right there. Remember the word better, right? The point of Hebrews is to show you that Jesus is better than. Anything you had in the Old Covenant, he's better than. He's fulfilled that. And so don't drift away from Christian, you know, your Christian way of life and go back into Judaism. He's better than what you had. He's fulfilled what you've had. So now in these last days, while he spoke many ways years ago, now in these last days, he's spoken to us in his Son. And then he describes a little bit here who that Son is. It's that Son whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the world. And there's so much in this verse I want to unpack, but I don't have time to unpack. But I want you to notice in the verse 2, it's through the Son that He made the world. Now, what does Genesis 1:1 say? In the beginning, God created. But what does Hebrews teach us, and also Philippians, I think, as well, or is it Colossians? Colossians also says He created through the Son. So God the Father decrees creation. God the Son does a creating. And God the Holy Spirit's covering over. Remember in Genesis chapter 1 with that? So it's through the Son that creation has appeared. But the second thing I want you to notice, because it just struck me as we were reading it, the first four words in this translation, verse 2, says, in these last days. Now here's what I sometimes think when I hear it, when I read that. If the writer of this letter says, hey, by the way, we're living in the last days. Well, what year is this written that he's saying in the last days? Probably end of the first century. That's just guess. Let's say the year 80. I mean, I'm just throwing a number out. I say 80. All right. Now, I want you to think about this logically for just a minute. If in this letter, the author is saying, in these last days, and it's about the year 80, and they're calling that the last days, then how much closer must we be to the last days? If now we're 1,000 and... what's that, 1,900, you know, some days later? There's a big difference there. Even in this first century, they were saying, you know, I think we could be in the last days. So in these last days, He has spoken to us in His Son. And then He goes in verse 3. I don't have time to do it. But verse 3 is so, what I would consider, kind of Christological, where He's identifying deity with the Son as a radiance of the glory of God, exact representation of His nature, upholds all things by the word of His power. When He had made purification of sins, that's at the cross, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, etc., etc. And then here's your first better. Look in verse 4. Having become as much better than the angels. Okay, this is going to be the pattern in the book of Hebrews. He's going to show you how He is the Son of God, eternal, through whom God is created, but He's better than anything you are accustomed to in your past. I like that. I think that would make a good sermon. Wouldn't that make a good sermon? I think it would. So that is how He starts the letter. So in chapter 1, verse 2, how did God speak in these later, more recent days? He did so through His Son. Now, I'd have spent about 10 minutes longer on that than I had planned to spend, but I just thought that was a really good point. Now, look at the paragraph at the bottom of the page. So, the author of our book says, this is the best way God could communicate with us. And I would agree with that. By sending His own Son to us. Hey, what's the, I just thought of this. What's the slogan of the Hallmark card stores? Isn't it Hallmark that says this? When you care enough to send the very best or something like that? Wow. Hebrews, or yeah, that verse there, that's a Hallmark verse. I just thought of that. When you care enough to send your best. That's what He did. The best way God could communicate with us was by sending His own Son to us. Jesus was the greatest word God ever spoke. And they give you the reference of John chapter 1, verse 1. Remember, that's where John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So this is God's communication, His Word to us. The writer of Hebrews wanted his readers to know that Jesus brought the great message from God that the Old Testament promised. God no longer needs many prophets and many methods because He has spoken once and for all through Jesus Christ. Okay, there's your better than, right? I don't need the visions, don't need the dreams, don't need the clouds of fire, because now He's spoken to us in His Son. That's a good start to this letter. I hope you would agree. So give me anything in that section there that you want to ask about, add to, before we jump to the next little part of our book. Okay. So let's look at the next section. What they're going to do here. The author says, we've learned that Jesus is God's greatest spokesman. in this letter called Hebrews, we can see other ways in which Jesus is greater than, okay, there's your better than, okay, he's greater than any other man or Old Testament leader. And in these following passages, they're going to show you what makes Jesus even greater. Now, let me do this first. I'm going to make you a list up here, and we'll see some of this as we go. So when you think about in the book of Hebrews, where it emphasizes he is better, let me give you several. I'm sorry, I don't write very well. There we go. Well, here, let me finish that too. All right. Let me give you about four or five examples of what you're going to find in the book, or the book of Hebrews, where he emphasizes how he is better than. So number one that we just saw a little bit ago, the writer to the Hebrews says he's better than the angels. So no matter what you may think about angels and their greatness and what they can do and maybe some of their, you know, supernatural qualities, he says, hey, Jesus is better than that. Now, he also then goes elsewhere in the book and says he's also greater than, better than, your great lawgiver, right? Moses, lead the people through the Red Sea, giving them the Ten Commandments and all the rules. He's better than that. Then, another area where the writer will go, you'll see this a lot in the book of Hebrews, and this is what makes it a little bit difficult to understand. He says he's also better than the Old Testament priesthood. The priest offers sacrifices for his own sins and the sins of the people. He says Jesus didn't have to offer for his own sins because he's sinless. He's better than the priesthood you are accustomed to. Then he says Jesus also gives us a better hope. And you'll see this in the book as well. So again, whatever you may have come across for hope regarding Old Covenant, he's like, look, you've got a better hope now than you had back then. And that leads to, I think, the big one is in the New Testament, New Covenant, Jesus gives us a better covenant, okay, or a better agreement with God. So when he comes along and fulfills Old Testament teaching, the priesthood, what this writer, the writer of this letter does, he's like, look, whatever you had in the Old Covenant, he's better than, he's greater than, he has surpassed that. So now with this, if you look at, there's what, about eight or nine examples they're going to give. They're going to show you now, why do we say that he is greater than, or he's better than? So a lot of this is going to be a little bit theological, and then some you'll see in this list here as well. So here we go. Chapter 1, verse 5. First reason that the book gives to argue that he's better than or greater is he is God's son. And there's nobody else who can claim that title. So back in chapter 1 and verse 5, the author quotes the Old Testament a lot because he's writing to Jewish people who, of course, know their Old Testament. And so in verse 5, he does one of those quotes. I think this is from the book of Psalms. And he's like, I've told you he's better than the angels. Now let me kind of explain more. So tell me, to which of the angels did God ever say, hey, you are my son? None of them. Right? Because only Jesus could be the eternal Son of God. So he's making an argument for the greater than, for the better than, when it comes to the angels. So he is God's Son. A few verses later, he says, here's another reason that I would argue from this book that he is greater or better than. He's also been given a throne. So then he goes down here in verse 8 and 9, and he's quoting again from the Old Testament book of Psalms, and he says, but of the Son, okay, not with the angels, but of the Son, he says, thy throne, O God. And notice it's of the Son he says that, right? We're looking at God, deity with the Son. Of the Son, he says, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, thy God, has anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy companions. And he's speaking of the Son. But the first part of verse 8 says, thy throne, O God. So he has given to the Son a throne. Now, think about this logically. If he has a throne, that makes him king, Does that make sense? I mean, it does to me. So God has given to him a throne. Okay? He's better. He's greater. Third example they give in chapter 2. Not only does he have a throne and he's king, but he also argues in this letter that as the Son, he's been given authority over all things. Not only did he create all things, he also has authority over all things. So in verse 8, he's quoting again from the book of Psalms. And let's see, as he goes through there, he says, speaking of the Father, thou hast put all things in subjection under his feet. In subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him. But now we do not yet see all things subjected to him. We will one day. But we do see him who has been made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, in case you're wondering who we're talking about, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. So the point of this back in verse 8 is all things have been put in subjection under his feet. Okay? He's better than, he's greater than, he's an authority over all things. Okay, anyone to add, share, ask before we look at the next? So the fourth one they give here, and this is going to take us back to another one of these. We looked at the angels in the first part, and now we're going to get here to the Moses part. Chapter 3, he says, hey, he's greater than Moses. Better than, right? Because he is the Son of God. So this is going to be in chapter 3. And let's see, they've got us reading verse 1 through 6. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling. Now, I love this. Consider Jesus. That's another good sermon title. Consider Jesus. Now, who is he? He is the apostle and high priest of our confession. Now, look at how he identifies and connects him to Moses in these verses. He was faithful to him who appointed him, speaking of God the Father, just as Moses also is faithful in all his house. For he, Jesus, has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses. He's better than, right? He's greater than. Just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses, he was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son. You see the difference? Okay, Moses is a servant of God, but Jesus is a son of God. He was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end. So what is he saying in these six verses? Basically, he's greater than Moses. So Moses is great, right? Wow, a lot God did through Moses. But what happens is when the Son comes along, he's greater than that servant of God. So he's trying to build a case, trying to convince them, do not drift away from your faith in Christ as he goes. Now, I like number 4. Man, this is so simply stated, and it's so crucial. Here's what the writer also reminds us in this letter. In chapter 4, verse 15, he says, let me tell you another reason he's better or greater than. He never sinned. Now, can you count real quick on one hand the number of people you know who's never sinned? Ain't gonna find one. Right? So what does it say in the text? Well, chapter 4, let's see here, around verse 15. I'm going to go back to verse 14. He's arguing for the greatness of the Son. He says, since we then have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens with his ascension, and again, I'll tell you who it is. It's Jesus, the Son of God. We've got that kind of high priest, and hold fast our confession. And look at what he does in verse 15. Listen, we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but we've got one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. couple things are encouraging in this verse. Number one, he sympathizes with our weaknesses. He knows what it's like to experience temptation. He knows what it's like when Satan is against you, when your flesh is against you, when the world is against you. And yet the author says, when he fought those battles, he did so without sin. Right? This is a sinless Son of God. So he's greater than. He's better than. Right? I mean, to me, man, this nails it. If there's no other reasons, he is the sinless one. And that changes everything. The sacrifice had to be perfect on the cross. Hey, remember the Easter program with a little wooden fenced area there, the chosen one? It had to be a perfect lamb. And then, of course, we saw that with the drama. So he was a sinless one. The next example given to me can be a little bit confusing in chapter 5. So this blows my mind theologically, and hopefully we can work through it and it'll help us understand. So Jesus is better, he's best, because he learned obedience by suffering and brought salvation to all who believe. We'll look at the verses and then we'll unpack a little bit with it. Wow. So in verse 8 of chapter 5, it says, although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. Now let me ask you a question. Wednesday nights are informal. I'm getting tired of talking, so y'all need to talk. Let me just ask you a question theologically. This has always baffled my mind. How can the perfect one, how can the sinless one, the Son of God himself, and the Bible says he learned. Does he not already know all things? He learned. What did he learn? He learned obedience. Did he need to learn obedience? Son of God, not going to sin, not going to choose wrong. This has always blown my mind. So one of y'all theologians, help me real quick. How do you explain? The Son of God learned obedience for the things he suffered. All right, y'all help me. I'm going to be quiet.
He was perfect in the beginning, so he had to learn.
That's part of my question.
I've been learning all my life. He experienced the human need for learning. The human, he experienced what we go through as we're forced to learn lessons in our life.
We give a point to Stony Creek. All right. What do y'all think? The Son of God learning. So, I think that does help us understand this verse. Do not forget your theology. Jesus is God in the flesh, right? He is deity. 100%. But, he's also 100% humanity without sin, but still 100% humanity. So think about it this way. When Jesus was like a toddler, because we don't think about this, when he was a toddler, did right then he already have perfect knowledge of everything? Or in his humanity, did he still learn some things? Learn to walk, learn to talk, learn to use a bathroom, learn to read, learn to add. So if as a toddler and a young adolescent, he's having to learn, right? 100% humanity, he's learning. What the author says, even as he grows in life, I guess you could say he also discovered too the importance of obedience. But in his case, it was obedience that would lead him to a cross and through the suffering. To me, that's always been a hard verse to interpret if you don't remember that he is 100% God and 100% man. Now, how in the world, I don't always understand how those two, you know, two natures in one person, how do they operate? And if you want something really fun, I should have brought it tonight, but I didn't. If you want something really fun, open a theology textbook and turn to the chapter on Christology, like the nature of Christ. And there were about four or five views early on in church history where people were wrestling with, how do you mesh deity and humanity in one person? And there's three or four different views on that. I can't remember all of them. Eutychianism, monophysitism, Nestorianism, all these guys with these different ideas of how do we mesh these two. And I think it was about in the year, don't hold me to this, I think it was about the year 451 at a church council meeting where they nailed down how to identify, like to don't blend the natures, keep them distinct, but it's two distinct natures in one like person. But my mind still wrestles. Like how though, I mean, as you're growing up and you're learning, see, that kind of blows my mind. And the writer says, as he grew up in this verse, where was I at? In chapter 5, it says, he, although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. That just blood blows my mind, right? But don't forget, he's also 100% man. Now, look at the rest or verse 9, because this adds a second part to it. He learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect. Now, that can't be having been made sinless type perfect, because he's always sinless, but heaven maybe, is it maybe like being made complete here with these natures within? I'm not sure how that goes, but having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation. Context. He's better than, he's greater than. So what is he arguing? As he lived his life, although he was a son, we see perfection with his obedience, and that led him to become the source of eternal salvation. Nobody else on this earth was a source of eternal salvation. So he's better than, he's greater than. Don't drift away from your faith in Christ and go back to your Judaism and your Old Testament law and Old Covenant, because you've got one now who has actually brought to us eternal salvation as our great high priest. Now, I'm just going to tell you, those verses in chapter 5 to me, verse 9 to me is pretty easy. I understand that with the salvation. But it's hard for me to grasp my mind around the fact that in humanity, he learned. That blows my mind. That blows my mind. And yet I know it's got to be true. As a toddler and learning and growing, finally grew in stature and wisdom with God and with man. So he's growing. And part of that in his life was the obedience that came through suffering. So, if you struggle to learn obedience, Jesus gives you the example. He learned obedience and never failed at it because he was perfect. So, anyway, that is always going to blow my mind when I read that verse in chapter 5.
Think of it as he learned how it felt from our perspective. From the human perspective. You know,
God the Father,
he took on human, which was different from all before.
Mm-hmm.
So, not that, you know, we know ourselves, it's the difference between knowing something and actually learning how it feels.
Yeah.
God the Father is not. He's not going to experience weakness. He's not going to experience temptation. He's not going to experience those things that are outside of his nature and character. But you enter humanity and you have to put on flesh. You're going to experience the things that we experience that are you know, outside of his.
Because now the Father's spirit doesn't take up space. There's no body. But once he puts on a body, now you've got some limitations by default. And that goes back to what he just said, that earlier verse we looked at. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. He's been there, right? He's learned obedience. He's learned. But he is one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet he did it without sin. So I think it kind of ties together with that. So give me anything else on that before we go. I know it's a couple minutes before or after.
I think this is one of the points where we can't understand it. That's where your faith comes in.
Yeah. Oh, I just thought, I was trying to think of this for a minute, real quick, in case y'all want to know, get on Final Jeopardy. In 451, at that council, when they were working on the natures of Christ, what they came up with is what they called a hypostatic union. That's what theologians call like the two natures in one person. And it's coming from a Greek word, hypostasis. Anyway, it just hit me. All of a sudden, that's what it was. I remember some things from my theology class. Most of it doesn't really matter too much because it's too deep, but I just remember that hypostatic union. All right, Ben, don't forget that. When Catherine asks you later tonight, you can.
So my Bible has a note that kind of ties together that suffering and that perfection and that obedience. So it says that his perfection was experienced from having actually suffered. He always had the perfection of being ready to suffer. He added to that perfection of having actually suffered. That's really deep.
Yeah, that's almost too deep for 804 when we end tonight. Or 805. Yeah, that. Wow. I'm just telling you, that to me has always been a difficult verse to fully grasp for me. But anyway, this author says this is another reason I'm telling you he's better than, he's greater than.
He's the